A warning to listeners or readers. The following content may at times include details about abuse, rape, suicide, domestic violence, and other types of trauma that may be emotionally confronting or triggering.
Welcome to Raised by an Invisible Village, where we unbundle the incredible power of the people who influence our lives. I'm Kathy Houlihan, your host, who will be guiding you on a very personal transformative journey. My personal story of uncovering the diverse characters that made up my invisible village, who together enabled acceptance, growth, and success. If you've been keeping up with my story to date, you may be just a little curious as to the circumstances that led me to becoming a ward of the state with the Northern Territory Government. In this episode, Homecoming, it will take you into the next chapter of my life. The title is a little complex as it takes in the short time that I lived with my parents after having spent the last 6 months with my aunt and uncle in Victoria. The deeper meaning for me is returning home to my birthplace, Alice Springs, and Bamtra. As you listen to what can only be described as unimaginable for a biological parent to say and do this to their child, it was also a time that I was incredibly fortunate to have, to this day, the most amazing memories and feelings of safety, acceptance, and approval during my time as a welfare child in my invisible village at Matthew Cottage, a crisis home for children at risk. Before I jump back into my homecoming episode, I would like to gently create a perspective on what this little 13-year-old girl was about to re-enter, a child of a Jehovah's Witness family. If you haven't listened to the first few episodes of Raised by an Invisible Village, it may be worth visiting these episodes in preparation. I am a disassociated from the Jehovah's Witness world, although I had never been baptized. My life for the past 12 months had been incredibly chaotic, impacted by severe trauma and homelessness. Lived with my auntie and uncle, who I'd never met, literally moved states, Northern Territory to Victoria, started a new school, made new friends, and had completely different life for 6 months. My parents had never made contact with me, nor my aunt and uncle, while I'd been living with them. I had not wanted them to be in that courtroom, in fact asked the judge for them to leave. This had only been a month or so earlier. I was still smoking. This was something that I'd been allowed to do while living with my auntie and uncle. And now I was about to go back to living with my parents, who while I was living in Victoria had relocated from Katherine to Alice Springs. Back to the world of Jehovah's Witnesses, back to restrictions, isolation, and rejection. Back to a world I really didn't want any part of. So okay, here we go, back to my story, homecoming. I don't recall any of the flight from Victoria to Alice Springs. My memory of this moment are pretty blurred. I do, however, remember that moment when I walked into the family home. My siblings were all excited to see me, running out of the house to give me a big hug. I was numb, though, as I walked into the house. My mother showed me to my bedroom, which was all on its own, separated from all of my sisters. It had a single bed, desk, and felt very empty. A very different feeling to the bedroom that I'd had with my auntie and uncle, which had felt warm and safe. And as was usual for my parents, a Jehovah's Witness Bible, watchtowers, awakes, and a book on being a teenager sitting on the bottom of my bed. Back to Bible readings every morning, prayers before each meal, and everywhere you looked in the house, Jehovah's Witness publication after publication. Within the first few days of being back in the family home, I was told that I would have to attend all the Kingdom Hall meetings, but sit right at the back. And as soon as the meetings had finished, I would then have to exit the Kingdom Hall and go sit in the car. One of those meetings finished around 9:30 p.m. and the location of the Alice Springs Kingdom Hall was directly across from the Juvenile Detention Centre and in an area that was well known for violence, vandalism and car theft. And I was not only expected to walk to the car in the dark, but then sit in the car while I waited for everyone to finish their mingling in the Kingdom Hall. I must admit that I remember feeling really quite frightened on the couple of occasions that I did this. In amongst this, I was told that if any visitors came to the house, I would be expected to go immediately to my bedroom. So here we go again, all this in my first week of being back in the family home. By the second week of being back, I had been enrolled at Alice Springs High School, Year 9, 3 different schools in 1 year. But now, having experience in making new friends, it wasn't long before I had started to hang out with a crew. My first friend, my sister, as we call each other to this day. You'll be introduced to Sophia in another episode, another character in my invisible village. Back at home and into my second week, it was getting a lot rougher. Standing in the kitchen wiping dishes with my mother, she told me all this in one session, that if I became pregnant, the child would be adopted out. Remember, I'm 13. And that my auntie and uncle, where I'd been living for the past 6 months, couldn't deal with me, so that's why they had to send me back. And then, of course, Auntie Ellen, who I'd held in the highest regard, had basically betrayed me. This is also one of the times that she would call me manipulative and that I knew exactly what I was doing. Hard to think that a 13-year-old knows exactly the pathway that she is taking. But anyway, I was also told that my school bag would be randomly searched. The venom of how she spoke to me was nothing short of hatred towards me. Me, who was supposed to be her daughter. Again, though, as I reflect back as an adult, my mother and father in their own way were victims of a ridiculous Jehovah's Witness environment. Their ability to control their spirited 13-year-old was clearly broken. They were also without insight, dealing with the aftermath consequences of that dark mental tornado that had ripped through an entire community. It is now getting closer to the end of having been in the family home for 2 weeks. There had been a visit from a welfare mediator who came to the house to facilitate a session with my parents and me, without a successful outcome. All my father could do was open up his Bible, where he had fully prepared with paper markers in various sections of the Bible. He would read these scriptures out to her like he was trying to convert another Jehovah's Witness follower or justify their biblical reasons for how and why they were treating me the way that they had and were continuing to do so. Total disregard that he actually had a daughter that was well, now truly back to that state of numbness, isolation, rejection, and just wishing her life could just end. It wasn't long after this welfare mediator visit that we were all seated at the dining table for dinner. I don't even recall what I was talking about, but I distinctly remember my sister saying, "You don't even understand your understanding." She was all of 12 years of age. My reaction back was, "What?" And then I felt a crack hard against my face. My father, who had been sitting to my right, had given me a huge backhand across the front of my face. Stunned, I got up from my chair, picked up my plate that still had food on it, smashed it on the table, and told them they could all go get fucked. Walked to my room, grabbed some clothes, put them into my school bag, and took off out of the door. This time, though, I was in a brand new town. I didn't know anybody, nor did I know where I was going. I headed into town. It was dusk and becoming dark. I'm not sure how I ended up in town, at the post office, but this is where I decided I would sleep for the night. It wasn't long before two police officers were walking through, and of course it would have been very unusual to see a young girl at that time of night laying on a bench seat. They stopped and asked me my name and what I was doing there. I remember telling them that my father had hit me, my face still had the red welt marks across it. They then took me to the police station, and clearly there were records of my previous history. Not sure how that worked way back then, but somehow they seemed to know a lot about me. A lady police officer came in to talk to me, and then someone from welfare. And that night was when I was taken to Matthew Cottage. When I arrived in a police car at Matthew Cottage, or maybe it was a welfare car, I can't remember, I was greeted by a beautiful lady, Sheila. She grabbed my bag from, I think, the welfare lady. They seemed to have a brief chat, and then Sheila put her arm around me. And I remember instantly feeling okay. There was something incredibly warm and comforting. Sheila directed me into the house through the front door. It was dark, maybe around 7:30 or 8-ish. Wayne, Sheila's husband, was waiting just inside the door, and he also greeted me with a, "Hello, I'm Wayne." And again, he also made me feel very welcome as I entered into the house. As I walked further into the house and into the main dining area, all these girls started to appear. Three of the girls were a lot younger than me. Two looked like they were around about the same age, maybe 10 or 11, and then the littlest one was only about 5. And the other girl, who looked a little bit older than me, was really shy and standoffish. Sheila introduced me to them, and they all giggled and said hello. I would find out in later years that they were all wondering who I was. This girl with bright white hair and skin, and wondering why she would be in Matthew Cottage. And then apparently I said hello and smiled back. And from that day forward, well, for the next almost 2 years, we were a family. Core 5 girls, me the only white girl, along with Sheila Wayne, our house parents. From memory, my arrival into Matthew Cottage was about August 1985. The house was low set, had a really large lounge room, big kitchen, a pantry that was the size of a small bathroom. The dining table seated about 10 or 12 people and filled the entire dining area. There were 7 bedrooms. My bedroom was the closest to the living area, my own room that had 2 single beds, a desk and a couple of cupboards. And further down the corridor were the other bedrooms, 3 in the centre of the house that opened out to 2 separate toilets and bathrooms. Some of the girls shared a room while others had their own as well. There were 2 more rooms further along the hallway, where there was a door that separated Sheila and Wayne's living area. This was a place in the house that we never entered. The first morning in the house, I remember coming out into the dining area. It was a weekend and most of the girls were already up and having breakfast. Before I'd come out of the room, I could hear them laughing and talking. And then when I came out of the room, they stopped, looked at me, and were really unsure of how to interact with me. Sheila was in the kitchen and she quickly went about showing me the pantry and what food I was allowed to help myself to. I sat down with the other girls to have breakfast, and it wasn't long before we were all laughing and talking with each other, like we'd always been together. The following Monday, off to school, and my new world of normality started to kick in. As high school wasn't very far for me to walk to, myself and one of my foster sisters would walk to and from school together. I hadn't been in Matthew Cottage long before Sheila asked me if I would like a job, a carer on the weekends at a place called Blue Cottage. It was located about 10 kilometres out of town and was on a very large property called St. Mary's Village. There were other cottages out there as well, pink and green. These also were homes for children in crisis. Matthew Cottage was located in town and was part of St. Mary's Village. I was really excited about the idea of having a job, my own money. So off we went for my very first job interview, and then I was successful, pretty much starting that following weekend. At first, I was unbelievably nervous. There were 5 kids, all who had serious disabilities, all in wheelchairs, and a couple of them were actually my age. The first few times, trying to feed, bath, and change nappies was extremely confronting. But it wasn't long before I was super comfortable with the everyday routines within the cottage, and taking them out on outings like shopping, or dragging their wheelchairs down into the dry riverbed to have an afternoon picnic. Every weekend I would ride my bike all the way out there, work around 5 hours every Saturday and Sunday, and ride all the way home again. I am almost certain that this job kept me well and truly busy and out of trouble. But it also provided me with the insight and reflection that my life was really not that bad. This experience of working from the age of 13, I actually carried into my own parenting, as the skills of confidence, work ethics, organisation, routine, and money equipped me with so many other life experiences that school just could not and still does not provide. Both my boys started working at 13 and have always retained amazing work ethic. November 1st, 1985, my parents' wedding anniversary. It's a strange thing in the Jehovah's Witness world that there is literally nothing that is celebrated except wedding anniversaries. So with my first paycheck, I decided to buy them a gift. It had been several months since I'd stormed out of their house, and from that time there had been no contact whatsoever. The gift I had bought them was a plant and a stemmed rose in a little glass bottle. Sheila made contact with them to let them know that I had something that I would like to give them. That afternoon, my parents, along with all my siblings, turned up to Matthew Cottage. It was kind of awkward. I hadn't seen them, and Matthew Cottage would have been a little bit confronting for them. But nevertheless, I wanted to give them something for their wedding anniversary. My parents came into the house, and together with Sheila, we stood there uncomfortably for a little chit-chat, and I gave them their gifts. My siblings were all in the car, and as my parents walked back out of Matthew Cottage, I followed them to say hello to my brother and sisters. After they left, I went straight into my room and I cried. Why couldn't I just have normal parents? Well, it wasn't long before Sheila came into my room and, with a great deal of anger in her voice, proceeded to tell me that my father had returned the gifts. His explanation was that he hadn't liked the conditions that they had been given to them. And in Sheila's hand was the plant. I grabbed the plant from her hand, stormed out of the house and into the lane that ran alongside our house into the street behind. I threw the plant so hard that it smashed all over the ground, just missing one of my mates who was riding his bike up the laneway. Hysterical, I literally could not stop sobbing. It wasn't long before one of the welfare workers arrived at the house. Jill was her name, the kindest, most gentle person ever. We all loved Jill. She got me into the car and we drove outside of Alice Springs on the north side, only the bush surrounding us, and she said, "Scream, scream like you've never screamed before." And so I did, and slowly the tears stopped and my sobbing started to subside. We drove back to Matthew Cottage in silence. It was dinner time and all the girls were at the dining table. The comforting sound of laughing, talking, and the dinner ritual of mashed potato and tomato sauce. They all looked up at me, gave me a hug. We then said grace and dinner was underway. Shortly after this event, I was soon seeing psychologists again, but I just couldn't connect with any of them. The last one that I went to told me that in the next session we would be smashing telephone books to bring my inner child out. And I remember thinking as I jumped on my bike to leave, "What a load of shit. I'm only 13. Is that not still a child?" The next few months were settling into the normality and routine of Matthew Cottage. School, work, sport, and blue light discos on the weekend. There were still the five of us call girls, Sheila and Wayne, and in amongst all of that were the stream of babies and toddlers that would be brought in to crisis care, and I would love it, bathing them and dressing them up in clean clothes. It also became pretty much the norm for us all to have the de-knit our hair, weekly hair treatments, but then we would all sit in a lineup going through each other's hair to shred out any knits that were left in there. So funny when I think about it. It was coming up to my birthday, mid-December, and I'd never had a birthday present. So my 14th birthday would be my very first time. A blue camera was my present, and to this day, I still have it in my keepsakes drawer. That year would also be my first Christmas. Wayne had curled up a sleeping bag under the Christmas tree to try and scare the girls into not sneaking out early in the morning to check out the presents. I remember being really excited to buy everyone a gift. I don't remember all the presents that I bought, but I do remember the youngest in the house. I bought her a monkey backpack, and she loved it so much that I'm pretty sure she slept with it. The Christmas holidays also meant that the girls were all going home to their family for a few days or weeks. This would mean driving out to Hermannsburg, Papunya, or Yindamu. Sometimes it would be most school holidays. Hours of red dirt into all of these communities. For me, though, I didn't have a family to go to, but what I did have, though, was Sheila and Wayne, and they took me to Canberra for a holiday. I remember it being absolutely freezing, but it was so much fun. I was introduced to lots of Sheila's family. We visited the War Memorial and went up to the Telstra Tower, my very first true holiday. Back from holidays, school was back. I hadn't had any communication from my parents or siblings. It had felt like many months had passed by, but my life was great. It was the norm for us: school, friends, a boyfriend, a home, and a job. In fact, by now, I had two jobs. I would ride back all the way over the north side of town after school to a fruit and veg shop where I would pack. For some reason, I would try and make it fun by beating the time of how long it had taken me to do the last pack of veggies. Pretty much a character of mine, always wanting to do something better and faster than the last thing. I don't know how many months had gone by, but there was an occasion that as part of a school excursion, we were walking from the school grounds to the town pool. As I walked along with my schoolmates, I could see my parents' car up on the lawn of someone's yard. And then all of a sudden, here are my parents and siblings. And I remember it being so strange. I asked my teacher if I could stop and talk to my family, and as it turned out, the family had just arrived back from Newcastle in New South Wales. Unbeknown to me, they had all moved to Newcastle months ago and had only just moved back. So bizarre when you think about that. Here I am, almost 6 months had gone by, no communication since that time of giving in their gifts for their anniversary, only for it to be returned. I don't know if there were any family visits or calls after that time of seeing them all in the front yard of their friend's place, but what I do recall is that it wasn't long before I was made a ward of the state. This meant that the Northern Territory government was now my legal guardian. The most weirdest thing here is that at the courtroom, which is where I had to go for the guardianship to be official, my parents actually showed up and seated themselves in the courtroom. So, so weird when I think back to this situation. The memories I have of Matthew Cottage during Cheryl and Wayne's house parenting days are to this day still one of the happiest times I can remember. The core of us girls, the numerous camping trips that they took us on, and the overwhelming feeling of acceptance, approval, and belief had a positive impact on us all. I'm sure that we would have turned a lot of heads when we were out in public. One white girl, four Aboriginal girls with two adults, and people wondering what our family dynamic was. Yeah, funny when I think back to some of those scenarios. Being the spirited child that I was, though, I still got myself in and out of trouble. Testing the boundaries as a teenager, the difference was, though, in the way that it was managed. There was this stage when sniffing preen or any type of aerosols was a thing. And yep, of course, I tried this, fortunately for only a very short period of time, until Sheila one day at the dinner table casually told us that sniffing anything kills our brain cells and that they didn't grow back. Well, we soon stopped sniffing aerosols, thank God. Well, the several times that we jumped out of our bedroom windows to meet up with our boyfriends in the park across the road, and all of a sudden our welfare workers taking us to Juvenile House, a detention centre for adolescents. We had a tour and basically we were told that if we didn't pull our heads in, this was where we were going to end up. Well, that scared the crap out of me. Brick walls surrounding the entire complex, isolation for the first 2 weeks of being incarcerated, a very small cell with a wide bed to sleep on, up at 6 a.m. every morning, and the food looked absolutely disgusting. All I can say is that during this period, it was fortunate that we weren't exposed to the types of drugs like meth that are out now, causing immediate addiction and other serious ramifications. I was a pretty compliant school student, well, I think so anyway. I didn't wag, despite most of my friends doing so. My marks were pretty average, and I seemed to get along with most teachers from memory. I felt like most teachers seemed to have an insightful understanding of my living situation, and there was a degree of compassion when there were times that I should have really got a detention. Like the many times that we would be smoking in the toilets, and the few instances we were caught and have to empty our school bags out in front of the principal. For me, I always seemed to be the one that had the pack of cigarettes that were confiscated, only for them to be returned later on. Another amazing memory that comes to mind, and one that I feel very fortunate to have been part of, was a 3-day camping trip along the Larapinta Trail with a group of other welfare girls, all of us being around the same age. When I reflect back to this time, it would have been something like a Breaking the Cycle program for kids at risk. It was so much fun. We learned a lot about each other, and being the only white girl, I was introduced to so many bushes and trees that were edible. Not really sure that I would try and remember which ones that could end up being fatal. I have a stunning photo of one of my foster sisters from this trip. This is my absolute favourite of all time, a yin and yang of a white and black face. I think of my foster sister often. And then the day came when our time together in Matthew Cottage changed forever. Sheila and Wayne sadly had to make the decision to leave. They had their own family that needed them, and the time came when we had to say goodbye. We were all so incredibly sad, and there were lots and lots of tears. I will close out this episode now, as the next one will take you into the next phase of my journey in life. What I would love to leave you with is that our lives in Matthew Cottage were filled with the most amazing and incredible characters who became integral components to my invisible village, most of who still hold a special place in my invisible village. From Sheila and Wayne, several of my foster sisters, my beautiful, intelligent school friend, Sophia, who was like a sister. And beyond those close connections, my invisible village extends to encompass all of those other people, including teachers, welfare workers, numerous school friends, and the extended community associated with Matthew Cottage and St. Mary's Village. To those whose paths I may never cross again, I am forever indebted and thank you. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Raised by an Invisible Village. I invite and welcome you into the next episode of my story, creating a safe and connected space for you and I. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the series Raised by an Invisible Village, and these real life stories have provided you with the opportunity to reflect about your own invisible village, a moment in time to uncover those who accept you, support your growth, and celebrate your success, and the recognition that you also are a character in someone else's invisible village, and how important our roles are as mentors, influencers, and champions. I'd love to stay connected and encourage you and others to join me by subscribing to my podcast channels. Together, we can continue to recognize the power of our invisible village for acceptance, growth, and success.